Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to the show. With me today, I have Audrey Holst, and she is the founder of Fortitude and Flow. She is a coach and has worked for 6 years in this capacity, helping individuals in groups. And she's got a book that's coming up, and it's called You're Not Perfect, and Here's How to Deal with That. And so welcome to the show today, Audrey.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So Audrey and I had a chance to be able to have a pre-conversation before we did this recording, and we got to know each other. That's been one of the awesome things. There's a lot of Facebook groups that I've been involved with and that she's involved with. And so when we cross paths, I've been doing a better job this year of actually saying yes to these Zoom calls, but I had to thank Audrey because I'm usually not the one who initiates them. That's my introverted extrovert part of me. But Audrey had reached out and said, hey, we should coffee chat. And I'm like, yeah, say yes, right? So let's do it. And we had a fantastic conversation getting to know more about what you do and the field that you actually work in and our overlaps and stuff of being able to help people. And one of the things that really came out of it was, I have this professional interest really in addressing how, you know, our histories and our backgrounds. And in particular, if we happen to have trauma somewhere integrated or severe dysfunction and adversity, you know, integrated into it, how it expresses itself at work in our professional lives, also obviously our personal lives. And obviously, you know, a big thing to me has been as a parent, you know, how it comes up and manifests in parenting. And for the listeners there and viewers, as Audrey and I were talking about it, we started to nibble on the topic of perfectionism and micromanaging and how they're kind of interconnected. And so the takeaway was, this would be a great conversation to have and record it and share it with everybody. So let's do that. You're here today to talk about, you know, what perfectionism is and like dig in on this. And so, you know, I have had the conversation before with other guests, and it comes up, you know, when we're talking about procrastination, like not following through until, you know, or finding reasons to not complete a project or self-sabotage and overwhelm and anxiety. But what is different about perfectionism above and beyond some of the things that most of us can kind of, feel and have dealt with probably at some point or another?
So I think something that is important to mention is these perfectionism interviews I've done recently, which was me having a conversation with over 60 people about their perfectionism. So having conversation after conversation after conversation and finding the threads that wove themselves throughout every person's experience. And these were all people that raised their hands and said, I consider myself a perfectionist or a reformed perfectionist or a lot of recovering perfectionists out there. I also had a couple of type B perfectionists, you know, because they're not a perfect perfectionist. That's the whole thing with perfectionism. It's like perfectionism all the way down. You know, it's not just like this top layer thing. It's all the way down. And so there's a couple of things that tend to be that are common that people talk about in terms of perfectionism. And I'm mentioning this because of what you just mentioned about people's experiences starting at the beginning and weaving their way throughout people's experiences. And so these are people from the very beginning of their lives were using this particular tool. I call it a survival mechanism, honestly. Like that is basically what perfectionism is. And this was something that they used at a very young age to deal with their lives when they didn't have a lot of autonomy. Right? These are things that are not unfamiliar probably to a lot of your listeners. I'm sure it's not unfamiliar to you. A lot of these things were a way that people people dealt with it was a lot of high achievement, right? They found that, oh, if I'm achieving, if I'm hitting these goals, if I'm being the good child, right? There's a lot of like model child things going on, then I am getting my needs met, right? That's where I'm getting my needs, is by this achievement, by this looking a particular way, by doing this particular thing. And this is something in its origins, basically weaves its way throughout people's lives and makes its way into their adult lives. And that's where it shows up in professional. That's where it shows up in personal. And there are a couple of things that are really common. I call them the four C's that I see commonly throughout all of the different flavors, right? Because that's the thing. Perfectionism is not this very particular thing. It has all different flavors and people experience it in all different ways. And, you know, we can talk about, you know, so-called symptoms. But there's a common need for control. There is this common comparison that's going on. There is this sort of sense of competition. And then there's also this theme of conditional relationships, right? The relationships are conditional upon these particular things being met. So these are some ways that I identify perfectionism in the way that I've worked with people. And I think it is, right, it's more a common thread and a common sort of nervous system that is making its way through life, as opposed to like, bad habits, right? Or things that like, oh, I just don't really feel like doing that. And it's kind of one of those things. There's this incessant, a lot of it is inner chatter, inner judgment. If I don't do this, then people won't like, right? What are people going to think? All of this sort of stuff is sort of an inner monologue that's running these people's heads on a regular basis. So hopefully that gives people a little bit of a better idea. Cause I think for a lot of people, they don't have language for what this might be until way later in their life, right? When I ask people like that, they're like, yeah, I just thought this was normal, right? When they're younger, this is normal. This is how life is. And then as they get older, they start to question, maybe when I'm looking around, maybe not. Maybe this is a very particular thing.
Mm-hmm. It, you know, you breaking that down in that way and listening to it, and I'm, you know, I bring everything in. So when I'm hearing something, I'm always like, you know, testing it inside of myself of like, okay, all right. And I'll tell you, I've never claimed to recover or be a perfectionist. Like that has never been a label that I've ever used to describe myself and my behavior. Probably because I'm also willing to throw myself into something that I might actually fail at, but I'll go ahead and do it anyways. But when thinking about the four C's, I do know like my own journey and my own history, and I'm sharing this not again, you know, just because in case other people are trying to kind of understand the nuances here a little bit. You know, I am a competitive person, always have been, you know, athletically, academically, professionally, you know, whatnot. Achievement was a way of getting recognition in my house, you know, my internal family system. I had jobs, I had functions. They were not glorious. It was a hero child role, yep. But it seemed really cool when my name ended up in the paper. Then suddenly I got like my true self got some sort of recognition outside of the house. And so, yeah. There is that comparison is always, I do know that I do that to myself, and I have this inner dialogue inside of me. That, you know, trying to do things and then feeling sometimes really dejected. I mean, you know, about that, but like I said, in the whole scope of all of that, I would never called myself the perfectionist type of it. And I think like I said, for me, because all those things are still this thing that makes my chest tighten up and go on side, you know, or going on inside of my head. But however, I do know that sometimes I feel like not wanting to take on an activity because I'm worried that if I don't follow through on it, that it's not going to get me the result that I want. And the result I want is a blue ribbon, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it sounds like that there can be, again, we talked about that nuances. There can be these shades of it that are mm-hmm. in there. When talking about people that say they're not a perfectionist, but might actually be a perfectionist, what do you think that maybe is that possible? You know, that it's a denial, you know, like I'm asking myself, like, you know, could I just be denying that some of that's happening? Like, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there, it's interesting because, even these conversations, there's different levels of, and I think what's important to say here is that I don't view perfectionism as this horrible, awful, we need to eradicate it type thing. right? I totally acknowledge that there are aspects of it that are useful and that there are a lot of aspects that aren't useful, right? And the aren't useful parts are the parts that we're interested in addressing, right? Because if you want something different, then let's get you something different, right?
Right, right. They're the parts that sabotage us and undermine our intentions and in what we want to do, right? Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So there's, I think that in conversation, right, there are people who hear perfectionism, it's like their ears perk up a bit, or maybe perhaps they've been told, a lot of people have been told they're perfectionists. So there were conversations I had with people who were curious or maybe suspicious, but weren't really sure and wanted to tell their stories. And there are other people who just were kind of relaxed into it and said, yeah, this is something I identify with, and this is something that I'm working with. And it's a very different relationship when people are feeling like, okay, this is really something I identify with. I identify with this, this, and this. And these are the pieces that I don't like, right? These are the things that I spend way too much time and energy on, things that don't deserve my time and energy. It makes me resentful. I'm really judgmental, right? We're talking about that micromanaging piece. Like, if you are a leader in a role where there are people who are supposed to have tasks delegating to them and they literally can't do anything without you having approval, right? Maybe you're the bottleneck on something because you need to approve everything before people get to you. Or, you know, you're micromanaging the how on everything, right? People can't do anything unless it's exactly the way you say it is, right? There, these things start to be disruptive in relationship. And I think that that's a lot of things that people start to realize with perfectionism is it makes it very impossible to have authentic, honest, real relationships with people. Because the other thing with perfectionism is I asked people about their internal experiences versus what people would perceive on the outside. And most of them would say the people on the outside see me as a really responsible, you know, detail oriented, good employee, all that sort of stuff. While my current experience is suffering, anxiety, working too hard, right? So there's this disconnect between what I'm putting out, what people perceive me as, and what my internal experience has. And that disconnect is extremely difficult for people because it's like my suffering produces good results for other people. And that's not a good situation either. So that's another piece of that that might be worth mentioning.
Yeah, absolutely. That totally is worth mentioning because it helps you measure again, whether or not what you're experiencing, feeling, doing is beneficial to you or harmful to you, right? It is the, how much of a struggle do you have going on inside of your head and how much pain are you feeling as a result of this? Right. And then being able to take the temperature of that pain in your life and go, yeah, actually, you know, I do those things. Like if you had good results, like if you did those things and you had positive results and positive relationships, well then your personality and who you are is good, yeah. Right?
Right.
It may be unique and different, you know, whatever it is, but like you pointed out there, that's a really great way of understanding is like, but it cause you a lot of anxiety, depression, overwhelm, and is it getting in the way of, you know, making those relationships? So I like that and appreciate that. Now, how did you find yourself into this world of addressing this particular, I don't want to call it, it's not like a diagnosable thing. It's not in the DSM or anything like, it's not an affliction. It's not a disease. It's just a pattern of behavior and mindsets and stuff like that. But where did you find yourself kind of into this space and working with people on this in particular?
It was basically following a thread. And that's kind of how I work in general, is just following the threads. And so it's also obviously, I don't want to say, I mean, maybe obviously, but this is something that I have personal experience with and, you know, a personal background in and decades of my own embodiedness with perfectionism. And so this is something that actually, when this term landed for me, and it kind of came in while I was writing the book. So let me back up. My background is in mindfulness, meditation, and yoga. What's interesting about that is when people hear that, they might have a particular, okay, that's interesting. I should mention that the style of yoga that I was involved with for 16 years was Bikram yoga. Now, if anybody has any familiarity with that type of yoga, it's done in a 105-degree room. It's done with a very specific series of postures. And the people who practice that type of yoga tend to be very A-type, controlling, want to do things perfectly type people. So when you imagine people practicing this type of yoga and somebody who was taught a very specific way under very specific rules, so much as that there are specific words that you are supposed to say when you teach this yoga, talk about a perfectionist dream, right? I have the measurable ways to do this thing. And I would notice that people within that practice, you know, they were more attached to how to do the thing the perfect way than what else was possible, right? Even paying attention to their bodies, even paying attention, you know, people would injure themselves to get things right before they would like go off in their head that, oh, I'm noticing this and maybe I should back off, right? So this was like the population I was a part of and was involved with for 16 years. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, I was training I was helping ride and often training off the track racehorses. So that's like, again, animal, but like high achieving, high strung. This is my life is high achieving, high strung, being self and working with. So when I became a coach about 6 years ago, just getting into the process of things, you know, I work with the people that I work with. And a lot of the people that I was working with were coming to me with burnout. So I was thinking, okay. So maybe burnout, right? Maybe burnout's the thing. Maybe burnout's the thing I want to talk about and work on. And getting into that, right? I did a lot of stuff with burnout. I'm like, this is interesting. You know, I'm starting to see these people. And the thing with burnout though, is there's so much organizational aspect to burnout, right? There's so much systemic with burnout. And I'm like, that's not my gig. I'm not that person, right? I'm not going to go into a company and we're not going to revamp the systems. That's not me. I'm the interpersonal person. Like I want to get in with the person and like, let's vibe there. That's what I'm interested in. And so I was having this conversation with my coach one day and she's like, these people sound like perfectionists. And that just, it was like a rock dropped in the pond. And I was like, wait a minute. That's interesting. And so at this point, my book first draft had been written. I was in the first round of editing and I started to kind of flip my lens and start to look at my own story and the story of the people I was working with and the people I was talking to as a whole through this lens of perfectionism. And when I started talking about it in that way, people went, that is me. And the people that were saying that is me were the people that I feel like I can best serve and that really I click with best. So that's been kind of the journey, is just following the threads. And again, my own embodied experience, I think, is helpful to understand things feel really big for people, but intellectually they're like, this should be easy. I should be able to do X, Y, and Z, but I'm having such a hard time. I feel like I can't do that. So that's the journey. That's the continual journey.
Yeah. I was gonna say it's ongoing, right? Well, when we were talking before in our pre-chat, getting to know each other thing, you know, I have this tool that I use in my coaching and consulting practice, called Predictive Index. And it's, you know, for anybody that's taken a personality test like Myers-Briggs or DISC or anything, it's in the same family of that, except it's used in coaching and organizational development and team building and stuff. And so it's got a whole nother software platform that's very different. And I sent Audrey one of these links to be able to do the test. Cause I was curious, like, you know, I like to look at data, right? Like we have the conversations and sometimes we do have difficulties really having enough language and vocabulary to be able to describe, you know, our experiences. I mean, think about going to the doctor and the doctor's asking you to describe your symptoms. Well, if you only have four words to talk about pain, you know, exactly. You might not be able to give them the right information for them to zero in on, you know, what's the cause. So to me, that's where data lives in my life. Data is like these data points. And so, you know, your profile came out as this collaborator, a person who is, you know, like, let's get in with everybody, which I think is beautiful for a coach. Because it is being able to understand the person's experience. The thing that I expected, and I'm not perfect at this, was that, you know, one of your other factors would be really towards the precision end of the scale, but actually you're much more flexible, but your patience is very steady, like to keep it on an even keel. So you're part of perfectionism and your relationship with it. It seems like for you to be able to get back out of it, maybe because you're able to have some flexibility in your life. But I wondered out loud when I, cause I was curious about seeing this, was whether or not somebody would then feel like their precision is dialed up way high. Like that's the perfectionist, you know, part of it, which is if I can't cross every T and dot every I, I'm going to freak the fuck out, you know, in life.
Yep. Yep.
And is that what you've seen is like, because I know that's not me. And I think that's like the big break of why I would never say I'm a perfectionist, because like I said, I'm all about the MVP, minimum viable product. Let's get it out there and let's like build the plane as we fly kind of a thing.
Yes.
But a perfectionist is going to be like, I can't even take the next step until I know it is all locked in. Right.
Yeah. And some people are, and that's exactly right. And again, this is kind of the flavors, and a lot of people who have studied perfectionism may put it into different categories. And this is why it's so complex. And this is why it's interesting to continuously build language and have these conversations and to have people hear about perfectionism in different ways, because some of it will land, some of it will not. And again, it's not to be like, oh, I need to diagnose myself as a perfectionist or not. It's just to say, okay, if I am experiencing these particular things, this just gives me some more knowledge. It gives me some more information. And then I, perhaps with this information, I can pursue something that works better for me. So there are ways to talk about perfectionism in terms of people who have that strong perfectionism towards micromanagers who want everybody around them to have it dialed in, because that's going to make them feel better. So that's what they want. They want to control everybody around them so that they can feel better. Then there's a perfectionist who really turn that perfectionism inward on themselves super hard and are saying, okay, like I got to get this stuff. Everything has to be right because I don't want to get anybody upset. And I need to, like, that's how I'm going to control all of this from this direction. Then there's people who are just trying to get it right in general. Like, what does society expect of me? That's what I'm trying to meet all of society's standards that way. They're also like the kind of covert perfectionist, which is a really interesting thing, where they are so terrified of getting things wrong that they don't engage at all. And then, so from an outsider's perspective, somebody may look at that person and go, you're actually kind of a slob. Like, there's nothing about you that I would think is perfectionist driven, but their internal experience is like, okay, I'm not doing any of it because somebody else is going to do it better than me. So why even bother?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that actually you can see that expressed in like resilience, you know, a person of that kind of nature may actually have lower resilience overall, because you're never tested, and we have to be tested. We have to be pushed and stretched. That's normal. You know, good stress is normal. It's how we learn how to do better at protecting ourselves and surviving ourselves. But yeah, if you're terrified to do anything, or you always go for low hanging fruit, you always go for the simple blue ribbon. And then once you experience your first like solid defeat or failure or, you know, mistake, it can be catastrophic to your mental well-being, because you just have never really kind of, you know, gotten to that next threshold to push yourself there. That's a great perspective to bring in.
Totally. And there was something, that you just said that I wanted to touch on. It just kind of went out of my brain. That resilience is definitely something that is, people have awareness around. This is kind of funny to me also, that people tend to find me right before crisis or something big happens in their life, and they need to build up those resilience muscles like, and fast. And I'm always like, that's such a great timing that we started working together, because here you are in the perfect situation to be building these muscles. I mean, it's great. It's better to build the muscles before the fire hits than to be building the muscles while the fire is in progress. But I think for most of us, that's honestly where we start building those muscles, is when the fire is in progress. So,
right. That's interesting. Well, you bring that up and I just wonder out loud, you know, before we begin to like develop our own sense of mindfulness and awareness, you know, we tend to be really excellent at self-sabotage. And sometimes the fires are things that we actually create, whether we want to acknowledge it or not. Is that something that you think happens sometimes when people reach out? Like, they already know that they're putting the pieces to it, may not consciously, right? Nobody consciously decides that I really want to see how I can totally foul up my life today or this week or at this job. We just end up falling into these ritual behaviors that are like in the wiring and in the neuro pathways. And until we know that that's what we're doing, we just keep replaying it. So we at a subconscious level know where this is going, and it's going to end badly. Relationship, job, whatever it is. And so I wonder, like, if that's, which is great if people come to you, if that's their mental state, but do you think that that is happening sometimes, that people can subconsciously see that this is going to crap out on them faster and they want to like not do that?
Yes, yes, 100%. And I think the other thing, when you mentioned the blue ribbons, this is coming back to me, and I can weave this in. One of the things that happens is the more success a perfectionist gets, the more terrified they become of losing it. Mm-hmm. So it becomes this, okay, I've hit this bar. Oh, right. Now I got to hit the bar above that one. And now I got to hit the bar above that one. And I need to hold on to this for dear life, because if I let go, it's all going to fall apart, right? There's that kind of feeling of, if I'm not holding tightly onto everything, it's going to implode. And there's this like catastrophe train that happens, right? That always ends with, and I'm going to die, right? It's like mm-hmm. that embodied in nervous system. Like all of these terrible things are going to happen. And at the end of this story that kind of my brain takes is, I'm going to die. That's always the thing, right? So there's a lot of that feeling where people go, I notice that what I'm doing is not sustainable, and I keep doing it, and I'm trying not to do it, but I can't help myself. And I know that this is not going to end well if I don't do something soon. So I think that's a lot of, that's like where that awareness point comes, where I'm like, come on in, let's take care of you, honey.
Yeah. Let's get off this train.
Yes. Let's get off the training.
Yeah. One of my episodes this season was with Lindsay Gibson, and we actually talk about the big fear, which is what you were talking about. And for, you know, especially if people have experienced some trauma in their life, you know, death and failure can get linked in together, and it can actually really get in our way, that we can literally think that we're going to die if we achieve, you know, the next level or, you know, something maybe, or that, you know, the shoe's going to drop as soon as we have any kind of success. So it, you know, it's the protector system inside of us that keeps us from pushing ourselves because of just really, honestly, some trauma and memories of when we tried to be better or do something, we got slapped in the head or, you know, punished or whatever, you know, may have happened, ignored, abandoned, neglected, you know, by people that were not supposed to do that to us, growing up.
Yeah. And something that it's also worth mentioning, and I can't remember if we had this conversation previously, but the fact that the way that our school systems are built actually feed into perfectionism, and perfectionism is actually a growing problem in adolescence. And it's not making us better. It's actually making us more anxious and more depressed. Because if you think about the way that achievement is oriented in school, it's not this setup of, oh, okay, you did this thing and it's not quite there. Let's have a conversation. Let's figure out how it can be done better and then go from there, right? You get one chance. You take that test and you get one grade on it and then you move on. You are fed very specific information that you have to go through the information in a specific way, regurgitate it a specific way, and you get one chance to get it right or get it wrong. And that's it, right? There's all of this feeling, because this is one of those things with perfectionists too. You got to get it right on the first try. You don't get a second chance. So you better nail it right now or else, right? That the what's going to happen is not going to be good. So that feeding, for anybody who even has a teeny bit of tendency towards that, the way this, when they go through school, that is constantly reinforced for them over and over and over again. So it makes complete sense why people feel the way they do and why there is so much pressure to get it right on the first try. And as opposed to, right, this learning mindset or this growth mindset, you either have it or you don't. You're smart or you're not. And that's it.
Right. Which, right.
If you want to build a resilient human, hello, it's not really a great start.
No. And it, you know, we can spin off and talk about schools and bitch about all that, because as we know, like, you know, children have different experiences, and we can talk about children today and we can talk about ourselves as children, right? We all came from different experiences, things happening and shaping us. Then there's just our innate DNA and personality. It's all different. Yes. You know, our temperament is something that we don't have control over. And, you know, the way a system is set up is going to be so structured and inflexible and not be able to have the bandwidth. And the teachers don't have the bandwidth to be able to personally, you know, cultivate every student. And so, you know, and I've seen this discussion, and a couple of years ago, I talked about trauma-informed schools. You know, our standard school system is set up to hopefully capture 80% of the students. I mean, they know it's not going to capture. So what happens to the other 20%? Well, I mean, my kids fell into the 20%. So, you know, some of these kids fall into households where that 20% doesn't have any capacity at home to be able to help them and understand and see them and, you know, and provide support and assistance. And then they get lost. Why? Just because they happen to have a genetic DNA, a predisposition, a learning disability, you know, whatever the multitudes of systems are. And then I think about this, is I think about how many of us grew up, with the achievement. And then I know people that if they didn't hit that mark, it came with punishments and it came with, you know, I mean, you know, getting grounded, having, you know, like for not doing your homework, for not getting A's, whatever it is. I mean, that's just trauma built on trauma and built on trauma. So you're 100% right that, you know, that again, the school structure, which is our most sensitive period of our brain development, is breeding this anxiety into us, and either we could handle it or we couldn't handle it. And if we didn't have support at home, it made it even harder for us. And so of course there could be multitudes of adults dealing with, you know, trying to get the A and doing, and because of the fear of what could happen if they didn't get the A. So now we talked about the, and you've mentioned it here a few times, and this was something that I did want to address on the show, which is the micromanaging part of this, because you know, we've all experienced it. And sometimes, and I actually wrote about this in my article this week on, you know, being a hero leader, but not the good kind like Joseph Campbell talks about, but being the kind that Virginia Satir mentions about, like, it's a form of dysfunction. It's a role that we played, especially if there was, you know, communications, but for children that grew up in households where they were in charge when they shouldn't have been in charge, but they were in charge anyways, that the leadership that comes with that in your own house bleeds into business, and it can cause you to feel like you have to take on everybody's responsibilities for them. But when we talk about micromanaging, that's not necessarily doing the job for everybody. It's getting into how it has to be done and not being able to let that go. So break that down a little bit more of how that's a manifestation for, and to talk about that.
Yeah. I think that a lot of people may not see themselves as micromanagers, right? They may just consider themselves to be
thorough
and making sure that they know what's going on and they're taking care of, right? Everything comes back to them essentially, right? It's going to reflect on me. It reflects on me to my boss, right? Or to my, maybe my higher up, right? Everything is about me. There's this whole, like, it's about me. And what it is really about, it's like lack of trust, right? It's a lack of trust that your employees, and I think this has played out in different ways, which has been really interesting when people have gone to virtual work versus in-person work, and what that might mean to be like, well, if I'm not looking over your shoulder 24 hours a day, how do I know if you're even getting work done? How do I even trust that you're getting work done? Are you getting work done the right way? I want to be CC'd on every single email so I can see what's going on. Your inbox may be a total mess because you are CC'd on every single thing that everybody is doing. Again, so you might be the bottleneck because you need to approve everything. So now people are waiting on you because you have to look at everything and make sure it's done exactly the right way. And what it comes down to is exactly as you mentioned, it's the managing of the how versus the what. What's the product? What's the goal? You know, this is something that I do very poorly with because I'm somebody who, the rules are flexible for me. Mm-hmm. I don't mind, you know, like I give me the goal, tell me what we're doing and I'm going to get there. I do very poorly with micromanagers because if you're going to be down my throat every single second, and like, I need that freedom from structure, right? If you look at my index, I need the freedom from structure. I need that freedom of expression. And if I don't have that in a workplace environment, then all that patience that I'm really good at,
it wears thin.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that there's a lot of people just being aware of their own need for control, or this, the anxiety that gets racked up with, again, what is going to happen? There's this story of what is going to happen, right? I got to hold on tightly. I got to make sure this is managed because this means a lot about me and what's going to happen. And this trust that, like, look at the hows, right? Look at what the employee is actually doing. Take a breath. And see, is the product getting done, right? And if people are not, then okay, maybe you're having conversations. How can things be done better? How can they do things better? I wrote about this in the book, and this is kind of a silly example, but I think it gives a good illustration of this. So there was this game, I don't know if you've ever played video games or a while back, it was called the Untitled Goose Game. And in this game, you play this goose that did all these naughty things, and you had a checklist of all of these tasks that you had to do, which, hello, so satisfying, right? Check the list off. Yes, give it to me. So you were this goose checking off these lists. And so I was playing it with friends at the same time. And so I would watch them go to check off something from the list. And I could feel myself getting very irritated. Like, that's not how you do it, right? That's not how you do it was the feeling. Like, that's not how you do it. Like, I wanted to jump in and like say something and tell them how to do it. And like, this is how you do it. And I noticed that. And then they would solve the issue in a completely different way. And maybe in a way that was way easier and way simpler than the way that I thought. And I was like, oh, that's a very interesting thing to be noticing. And that is something with the micromanaging, right? That feeling of like, they got to do it this way. There's a right way to do it. There's only one way to do it. There's my way to do it. Or maybe not.
Yeah, no. And that brings us into I think the really good kind of segue here to talk about noticing, because, yes. You know, I know that through when people ask me, like, you know, when someone's going, oh my God, maybe trauma is underneath my, you know, my management, my leadership, you know, my interpersonal skills, what do I do? And to me, it is start to notice your body first. Your body is making, you know, your brain is making a split second decision based on what your eyes just saw, what your ears just heard. And it looked backwards. It found a memory and it said, this is what we're going to do next. And you feel it because the surge of hormones just go. Either your chest tightens or you get flush or your gut sinks or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Once you start to notice that, game over. Like, I mean, your whole life just changes from that. And you talk about that, like, so, and like what you just said there, which is a great example, right? Like noticing those language, what other ways can this noticing effect or process be integrated in for somebody who feels like the perfectionism is getting in the way of their relationships, their authenticity, you know, their work and personal lives and whatnot?
Yeah. The noticing is the number one thing. And it's the most important tool that I teach clients is just this noticing practice. And the noticing practice that I bring people through has essentially three layers. There's external noticing. When you're actually taking in your environment, you're looking at your environment, because a lot of the times we're so in our heads and our stories that we are somewhere else, right? The brain does not know the difference between that story it's writing and the fact that you're just sitting in a chair, literally going nowhere, but your body is going through a journey because it thinks it's somewhere else because you're going through that. So noticing physical environment and starting to anchor and be okay, visually, I am where I am. And my system is starting to recognize that. I'm looking at the room. I'm looking at the corners of the room. I'm looking at the door, right? So just external noticing is can be helpful for people, especially when they get sucked in to, some people can get so sucked in that they can't get out, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The other thing is just physical noticing. So you start to notice, all right, noticing sensation, noticing senses. So what can I smell? What can I hear? Feeling my body weight. You know, where am I in contact with something? Textures. What is the texture of my clothing? If I can touch it with my skin, if I rub my hands together, I can feel my fingerprints, right? Just starting to tap into these physical sensations. And even I just took a breath, right? I can notice there's a physicality for me actually breathing, right? My body physically moves when I breathe. That's an interesting thing to notice. And then when you're talking, right, this is sort of the, where we really get into it, is that interoception, right? Those physical sensations that are an indication of something, right? That's one of the things that I start to talk about noticing is just notice that something happened. Mm-hmm. Something has happened, because the perfectionist two-step is see it and fix it. There's no pause. There's no decision-making. It's see it, fix it, see it, nail it, see it, get it right. But, you know, that is the fast reactionary way. Well, if you don't notice, there is no influence. You have no choice there, right? So now I'm starting to notice something just happened. I don't know what's happened. So when I talk about the noticing, my coming to a noticing practice was being in an interpersonal meditation practice with other people, and somebody actually using the phrasing, because I think that this is something that not everybody has had an experience with. I didn't get here until my 30s, was somebody had mentioned something had made them upset. And they said, you know, I noticed that my chest is tight. I noticed that my belly is clenched. And those words, I had never heard anybody speak to their experience in descriptive physical words. And that's how I'm wired. And I went, wait a minute. And that's when I started to pay attention to these things and as physically described sensations, and my entire everything changed for me after that. When I started to understand my experiences, physical sensations, how much better is it to just say, okay, I'm having this physical sensation that's really unpleasant versus I am so anxious. I don't know what to do. I don't know where to go. I have to deal with my anxiety, as opposed to going right to that physical sensation. So that's the noticing, notice the external, noticing the physical, noticing the sensational, just noticing it just to begin with, because we don't have the information because we don't even know it's there.
Right. I mean, you can't take any actions right away.
No.
You know, and I know you use this language a lot. And this is something that I think is an important word, is just, you're just curious at this point. In the early stages, you don't need to be an expert on anything, but you know, the act of noticing when we are triggered or something has happened to the body, we have now forever changed that experience.
Yes.
Because like you just said, the perfectionist goes to, I'm going to fix this right now, right? That's the stress response system. It's the take action, do something.
Yes.
And you, that again is based on looking backwards at a memory and deciding that when it happened to us in the past, it sucked. And so this is what we need to do to make sure it doesn't happen again. And for some people, it's to run from the room. It's to shrink up and say nothing, you know, and others it's to fight back or whatever. But for perfectionism is like, I need to get my hands on this and I need to make sure it's okay. Like right now,
yes.
Like,
yes.
You know,
yep.
But once you see that you are doing that automatically, you know, I mean, yeah, like I said, you can't unsee that, you know, it's like, and I know that when I've done sessions with people that they're always surprised by how often they respond. There's a physical response to something. If they've heard something that triggers dissonance, right? Dissonance is this, I've heard information here and it might be true, but I don't want it to be true. My brain's telling me it's not true, but what if it is true? And so then you feel a trigger, like your sense of ego and identity has just been challenged by somebody telling you something directly. And you just kind of like lock in and reject it or get anxious about what you should do about it. And that happens a lot at work, you know, and in our, you know, our professional lives. I mean, you know, critiques and criticisms and stuff like that. Go ahead. I see you like jump in. Jump.
So something that's important. So this is another thing that I thought was a really great observation that somebody made when I was interviewing is how many times have we been taught how to give feedback, right? You do the sandwich, you do, well, but there is, right? There's certain like feedback. This is how you give good feedback. How many of us have been taught how to receive feedback?
Yeah.
We have no, and this is one of the things that I think is important for people to understand. A lot of this stuff has not been modeled to us. We literally have no idea how to do it, or it's been modeled poorly. And now we think this is the way and it doesn't work, but we keep trying because that's literally the only thing we've seen or experienced or understood. We don't even know how to receive feedback. Nobody's actually told us like, hey, this is how to receive feedback. This is what you can expect. This is, you know, so there's especially the perfectionist taking it really personally and then getting really defensive. These are two things that are really common. So I think it's just important to mention things like this too, is we just don't know a lot of the stuff. We just don't know. Yeah. You can tell somebody how to give somebody feedback as well as you want. But if that person has no idea how to receive that feedback, that's tough.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was worth mentioning.
No, absolutely. I did an article a couple of weeks ago about messy leadership. And one of them is to, you know, one of the principles of, to me as a messy leader is to be able to receive feedback, not just from mentors and coaches, but from your subordinates and your peers.
Yes.
You know, because if we do have some experience with like, let's say athletics or extracurricular activities where it's not just school, but it's actually going out and learning new skills to do better. And then our coach or instructor is telling us and making those improvements. In a way, we do learn the feedback process there, but it's from a person who has an instructional power over us or, you know, a guide for us. And so we are giving into that as a student to that. But then when somebody that's on our same level tries to say, hey, listen, I notice that in meetings, you know, you tend to do this when somebody says this or, you know, whatever, or an employee trying to lead up to you says, listen, you know, I would appreciate some more flexibility in being able to do this. And I, you know, and when you come in and tell me every detail and how to do it, it frustrates me because I do think there's another way. Then you know, if you don't know how to receive that feedback back, I mean, it definitely is a detriment to your growth and opportunity, and leaders don't grow when they don't get the whole scope of their impact and influence, you know, on everybody. But to your point, yes, absolutely. That is a skill that we aren't shown and taught and don't know how to do it and receive it. And also sometimes, you know, not all feedback is going to be valid.
You know,
sometimes people are just mean-spirited, you know, and they just say crappy things or they don't have the information to give you feedback, which, so then you're sitting there with this, like, I know I go through this filter. In fact, my chest even tightens thinking about all the times that I've had people like step in with like 1 minute of experience with me and then wanting to tell me how to run my life. And I'm just like, fuck you and get out of here. Like, you know, like just an instant. But yet on the other hand, that can block you from actually saying, okay, hold on, slow down. Is there anything out of that that I can actually take and run with, you know, because my defense is just to tell you to go screw yourself.
And it's like, it all comes back to that noticing, right? You just notice that something happened and you take a pause when you're like, whoa, interesting, right? That's great. The thing. Interesting. Get curious, ask questions, right? Because I think that's one of the things too, when it comes to feedback and having conversations, what I'd love to see too, even right between the hierarchies, right? Make things so difficult, like you just mentioned. Interesting. Like, what do you mean? What do you mean by that? Right? Because that's the other thing. We're talking about this perfectionist, this word. What does it mean to me versus what does it mean to somebody else you ask about perfectionism, right? You have to ask those questions. You have to get curious about it. When somebody says something, get curious about what they've just said. Can you clarify that? What do you mean by that? In my experience, this means X. What does it mean to you? Because I think so many things we can learn in those pieces really takes that reaction down about 20 notches when you're like, oh, we're actually looking at the same thing. We're just using different language to describe it.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that's a good point. Well, so you have all this wonderful experience and these great insights. It's been an awesome conversation talking with you about it. So how can somebody who's listening to this, who's like, yes, I'm either recovering or would like to be a recovering perfectionist and they want to work with you, Audrey, what's the best way to get to you? Because you have the book that you're working on right now.
Yes.
And which is a fantastic process all on its own. And then, but you're a coach as well.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So as a person who's dabbled in perfectionism, what's it like deciding to write a book and going through the effort and the process of doing that?
It is a journey. It's so interesting. So I'll be completely, you know, transparent about where I am with it right now. So the book was, my first draft of the book was done in 3 weeks, November, 2019. I wrote the entire thing in 3 weeks. And then I put it down. I was working with my editor, put it down, picked it back up in the beginning of 2020. Then the pandemic hit. And this was also, so the pandemic hit, right? Things went a little bit all over the place. I mean, there's all sorts of things to say about that, but people can make their own assumptions and experiences with it. That's also when things shifted from burnout to perfectionism. So things started to shift within my business, within my languaging, that got changed in the book. And then I didn't have the capacity to work on it. Right. And I just was like, this is where I'm at. I have interest in this project. I don't have the capacity right now. So I put it down. And people have been saying for a long time, I can't wait to read your book. When's your book coming out? I can't wait to read your book. When's your book coming out? So it's been nibbling at me. Like, it's literally a physical sensation. When you're talking about how's the book, it's almost like the book is sitting on my shoulder going, how is the book? You know? Yeah.
How on is your shoulder.
Exactly. And so something that the practice that I've started to employ, because this is how I work, and this is maybe something that's helpful for listeners to hear too, is one of the parts of my process is the small, doable, consistent actions. I realized that I need to get back into relationship with the book, right? Right now I want to get back to editing, but that feels like too big of a piece for me to bite off and actually do. So I keep banging my head against editing going, this isn't working. So what did I do? I took the document, it's in a Google document, I put it on the homepage of my phone, and in the morning when I drink my coffee, I click on that document and I read it. I start to read the book and I start to go, wow, this is actually pretty good. Wow, I actually need to read this. Wow, other people actually need to read this. So I'm getting back into a better relationship with the book itself, which is making me now want to engage with it again, right? Then I will get back to editing. So that's like the thing, taking these tiny, small, doable actions to move towards something, which I think for a lot of us have been thrust, we've taken big leaps and we've been thrust into things and our only way of getting things done is to do it big or not at all. You got to take little teeny tiny bites off of stuff, realize you didn't die, it worked out pretty well, then you can take another bite. And that's how things change from the inside out. And I know you know that, and probably your listeners know that at this point too, but that's how I am getting back into relationship with being a recovering perfectionist, writing a book on perfectionism to perfectionists. As I said, perfectionism all the way down. It's pretty meta.
Journey. Yeah. Well, and as you're talking about the one, you know, I know, and I'm glad you mentioned that, like, you know, I can think of several, you know, well-known coaches out there in the self-help market that talk about massive action, you know, big things that you have to do. And I've heard that, but, and yes, that can be And it also can be that, especially I would imagine if you are, again, the dot, you know, the dot maker, T crosser, you know, thing, that really the most tolerable changes you can make will be small ones that you just get them to some completion. You get some reward for actually completing it, and you make those, and that is okay too. Like, it doesn't have to be, you know. And so, I mean, I'm, like I said, I'm glad you said it, because there's a lot of people that have made, you know, $1 billion telling you that you need to take massive action, big steps, and, you know, go big or go home. Cool. Yeah. Okay. But that's not for everybody. And I'm, you know, here we are talking about how that's not. So, okay. So then with your coaching, I'm going to have links to your website in the podcast notes for people to be able to click and get to you, but describe what it's like working with you, one-on-one or in a group.
Yeah. So, my one-on-one program is called Emerge, and it really is a lot of this foundational stuff we're talking about. So the process I bring people through, fortitude and flow, right? There's kind of two pieces of it: building fortitude, which for me means learning that noticing practice, really dialing that noticing practice, and then starting to practice discernment, because a lot of it is, I noticed this, now I notice it, now I want to go do something with it. Okay, before you do, before you get to the action, we have to practice some discernment. Like, let's tap in. We got to talk, we got to know, like, what is it, what are you about? Because that's what a lot of the things is. They know who everybody else is about. They are not really that sure who they're about. So there is this noticing and discernment practice, noticing and discernment, noticing and discernment. Then we get to the action, as I mentioned. So the flow is action and integration, small, doable, sustainable action, tiny bits and pieces over and over and over and over again to build back up that relationship. So you start to get to know yourself in a different way. You start to build up those different muscles. It's like, if you wanted to do a push-up and you could not do a push-up, the deal is you don't just try to do a push-up. Okay, maybe you start on the wall. You got to start those little muscles going. Maybe then once you get a little bit stronger, then maybe you go down to a lower bench. Then maybe you're doing push-ups on your knees, right? We get that with a physical body, which is all of this we're talking about, but we don't have that same perspective or expectations sometimes. Like you said, that massive action. Some people can just go do a push-up. Some people can't. So if you can't and you want to, where do we start? Small, doable. And then integration, which is like, take a pause, right? From one thing to the next thing, to the next thing, to the next thing. And all of a sudden you're like, how did I get here? I'm not even sure I want to be here. There was no pause. There was no integration. There was no letting my system settle. There was no, how did that go? What did I learn? Do I want to do it that way again? Actually, that didn't go so well. This is how I want to go moving forward. This is what I want to do going forward. So that's the process that I bring people through, is just starting to learn this, slowing things way, way down, taking their expectations into a little bit more of a realistic territory for them, and then working within that. Mm-hmm. So I work one-on-one with people. I tend to start with 3 months. Some people are like, boom, good, out. And then some people work with me for longer.
Mm-hmm. Cool. And so is that your website the best way to get you? Do you have,
fortitudeandflow.com. And then also, if people go to the link fortitudeandflow.com/podcast interview, there's also a little link to one of the meditations that I use that describes the exact noticing practice that we did today. So
cool. Awesome. I'll actually include that, also that direct link in the podcast notes, because that's actually a good thing, to the noticing. Because like I said, it's the go-to. If like you're going to begin anywhere, begin to just, you know, put the pause, I call it the pause button, hit that pause button.
Hit that pause button. Find
don't
the pause
judge
button.
It. Yeah. Fine. Yeah. And then, yeah. And don't judge it. Like, you know, like I said, like some people, like when they feel that, like, oh, I shouldn't be overreacting. Nope. Don't say anything. If you're going to say anything, just say that's interesting.
That's exactly. I love that phrase, because that, that covers a lot of territory.
Yeah, totally. Cool. Well, Audrey, this has been a fantastic conversation. Thank you so much for talking with me about this and sharing everything about with the listeners, you know, on this whole subject. I mean, this has been really cool. I really appreciate it. And I'm glad, again, I'm going to go back to thank you for reaching out and breaking my wall of getting a little too comfortable in my living room.
I love it. No, this was awesome. What a great conversation. And I can't wait for people listening.
Yeah, cool. Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquercone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team.
Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Perconi, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.